This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. John McCain and Barack Obama promised to ban active registered lobbyists from holding paid positions on their campaign staffs. But are the bans full of holes? Just because someone isn't a registered lobbyist now doesn't mean they weren't recently one, or that they won't go through the revolving door and return to lobbying after the election is over. We're going to take a look at the role of lobbyists in the presidential campaign. My guest, James Thurber, is a distinguished professor of government and director of the Center for Congressional and Presidential Studies at American University. He's written many books and articles about congressional reform, interest groups, lobbying, and elections. He worked with McCain and Obama on the lobbying reform bill that was passed 1 year ago. James Thurber, welcome back to Fresh Air. Well, since you worked with McCain and Obama on this lobbying reform bill, let me ask you, were they getting along together when you were working with both of them?
The two senators actually did get along very well and collaborated in the effort to have lobbying reform and ethics and procedure reform in Congress. There were a couple of times where they both wanted to take credit for things, and so it got a little tense then, but both were pushing for reforms.
What have they each had to say about the role of lobbyists in campaigns?
Both of them say that they will not have lobbyists on their campaign staffs, but also will not use lobbyists when they're in the White House. They say, we're going to change the way Washington works.
And how successful are they in changing the role of lobbyists in the campaign so far?
They haven't been very successful at all. In fact, some people think they're disingenuous when they say this. There are over 40 key former lobbyists, and some of them were former lobbyists just a few months before they got into the campaign on the McCain campaign, and probably about 20 associated with the Obama campaign at high levels.
Well, since McCain is ahead in the lobbyist sweepstakes numerically, let's start with McCain. He's called lobbyists birds of prey. Now, let's look at some of the people who are the top advisors in his campaign. Let's start with Randy Scheuneman. He's the campaign's foreign policy advisor. He's not currently a lobbyist, but what has his position been as a lobbyist?
Well, Randy Scheuneman is a foreign policy advisor to Senator McCain's presidential campaign. He heads Scheuneman and Associates and worked on behalf of numerous high-profile clients, including foreign nations, including the nation of Georgia. This became an issue when Russia invaded Georgia, and he gave advice to Senator McCain, and McCain came out very strongly condemning Russia. One wonders in that situation, since Scheuneman just left his firm a few months ago, who the client is. Is the client the president of Georgia and Georgia, or is the client John McCain, or is the client the American public? And a objective analysis of the situation makes me think that he leans heavily towards Georgia.
Does it make a difference to you that Scheuneman is not now officially a lobbyist? He's left his firm. I suppose he could go back to his firm after the campaign.
Well, this is quite common. When people get involved in campaigns, they go back to advocacy or lobbying, and they may not even be a registered lobbyist, but they're still lobbying. They're lobbying to sell something to the Defense Department or intervene in the regulatory process, or just set strategy for other lobbyists to intervene and try to influence Capitol Hill. It's easy not to be a registered lobbyist in Washington, D.C., and still be quite successful in monetarily in terms of advocacy here.
Now, Scheuneman was also McCain's foreign policy advisor in McCain's 2000 presidential bid. Do you think that that affiliation with the McCain campaign helped Scheuneman in his own lobby company?
Absolutely. When foreign nations look for lobbyists, they find people who they think are wired or connected to power. And certainly John McCain was in the Senate and is now as the presumed nominee of the Republican Party, but also was highly respected and well-known internationally as a result of his previous campaigns for the presidency. Many lobbyists in Washington use their connections in campaigns to help get clients. And then they also, after they have the clients, just take a little time off and go back into campaigns. It's quite a common revolving door.
Let's look at McCain's chief campaign advisor, Rick Davis. He has been a lobbyist. What kind of interests has he represented?
He's been a partner in a very well-known and successful firm in Washington, D.C. It's called Davis Manafort, and he's now the campaign manager. He was just a little bit about his background. He was a former aide in the Reagan administration and deputy manager of the Dole campaign in 96. He's been a well-known political operative, but also a lobbyist that has a variety of corporate clients in the top 100 corporations in America, as well as associations that are very concerned about advocacy here in Washington, D.C.
Well, what are some of the issues that McCain campaign advisor Rick Davis has lobbied for that you think might impact the kind of advice he would give McCain?
I think that Rick Davis has a major impact on the campaign and on John McCain and what John McCain says, even though John McCain is very independent, especially in the tax area. He's very much of a person who feels that we have to have major tax cuts to stimulate the economy, and he has many clients that would like that. He also has corporate clients that would not like a corporate tax as advocated by Obama, and he's certainly giving Senator John McCain advice about that also.
And I should say, Rick Davis is on leave from his lobbying position and his work for McCain without salary for a year. So does that eliminate the conflict of interest question?
I don't think that it does. I think that just not having a salary from Davis Manafort does not change his relationship in his mind with his clients and with John McCain. He's not advocating for the clients in the campaign explicitly, but he doesn't need to because he's influenced by many years of relationships with those clients.
Okay, moving down the list in the McCain campaign of people who have been lobbyists, Charles Black, what's his role in the campaign and what are some of the companies he's lobbied for or foreign governments and foreign leaders?
Charlie Black of the BKSH and Associates was very involved in the 2004 Bush campaign. He was a Bush pioneer. He's probably the most experienced and respected Republican lobbyist in Washington, D.C. He has a very successful firm. He's a close friend of George H.W. Bush, Bush 1, and served as advisors to Reagan and George W. Bush. He's been an official spokesperson for the Republican National Committee. And he has dozens of corporate clients that have issues that are related to this campaign in the area of energy, environment, tax, trade, issues that can cost a corporation hundreds of millions of dollars.
Now, among Charlie Black's clients have included leaders of countries, including some dictators. His clients have included, and correct me if I'm wrong here, Jonas Savimbi of Angola, the Philippine President Ferdinand Marcos, Zaire's Mobutu Sese Seko, Somalia's President Mohamed Said Barre. What concerns do you have about that?
Charlie Black has represented the heads of nations in Africa and elsewhere that have very questionable backgrounds in terms of the way they treat their people, the questions of human rights. He's been doing this for many years. It's a very lucrative business. At times, one wonders whether he ever says no to a foreign client.
Now, let's get to Phil Gramm. Phil Gramm is a former senator who was McCain's chief economic advisor, no longer is. I understand he's still close to McCain, and there are still rumors that McCain, if elected, would choose him as Secretary of the Treasury. Phil Gramm is not a lobbyist, but do you think of him as having lobbying connections?
I define lobbying very broadly. Phil Gramm serves as vice chair of an investment firm, UBS Warburg, and they certainly have issues before the federal government right now. He was largely responsible for the lax regulations that led to the Enron debacle and led also to some of this loose lending. Phil Graham is a conservative former Republican senator from Texas that is close to McCain. They like each other, even though he's stepped down as a result of a controversy recently, a statement about America isn't in a recession. He still will have a great deal of influence on the campaign, and he's likely to be called in to serve in a McCain administration, maybe as Secretary of Treasury.
Let's get to John McCain's wife, Cindy McCain. Now, she's the head of a beer distribution company that her father founded. This is Hensley & Company. And she and her children own about 68% of the privately held stock in the company. Is the company involved in lobbying?
All companies are involved in advocacy or lobbying. All companies have to deal with state and local regulations, but also federal regulations. Right now, the InBev Corporation out of Brussels, Belgium, is trying to buy Anheuser-Busch. Now, Cindy McCain's company owns $100 million worth of stock, Budweiser stock. The entire issue of whether Budweiser can be purchased or not is in the public sector. She is not, I'm sure, lobbying one way or the other for this, but she has a great deal to gain if InBev buys the company. It looks like that's going to happen. The Budweiser stock was at $42. The bid by InBev is about $64. She's going to make a great deal of money out of this.
Now, on a state level, Cindy McCain's company opposed initiatives in Arizona that would have raised liquor taxes and used that money to fund a statewide childhood education program and more pediatric hospital beds in poor communities. In the Senate, McCain has recused himself from alcohol-related issues. What would it mean if he were president and he had to sign or veto any kind of issue related to liquor, and Cindy McCain still owned the beer distribution company?
Presidents cannot recuse themselves on all issues. And if an issue came up related to alcohol and she still owned this company, or the 60% of this company, 68% of this company, this would be a huge conflict of interest.
The press has written a lot more about the McCain campaign connections to lobbyists than it has about the Obama campaign. Does that represent the reality of the campaigns, that there's just less lobbying or influence in the Obama campaign, that there are fewer people highly placed in the campaign who have been former lobbyists?
I think the fact that McCain has been in Washington, D.C. for so many years means that he has many more people that were lobbyists very close to his campaign. Obama is a newcomer. He certainly knows people, but he doesn't have intimate relationships with them. He has a few lobbyists in his campaign, former lobbyists in his campaign, certainly people that advocate and have not registered. But again, his theme is the same as McCain. He's just a little cleaner in terms of the number of people who've been in the lobbying business. Where Barack Obama boasts about not being of Washington, he says, quote, I'm the only candidate who isn't taking a dime from Washington lobbyists. That's where he's disingenuous. He is getting hundreds of thousands of dollars from non-lobbyists, from corporations. It's all transparent and recorded by the Federal Election Commission. And he, in fact, had $138 million so far just from law firms. Now, what do law firms do in Washington, D.C.? They advocate.
So when you say he's getting all this money from non-lobbyists, you mean people who actually function as lobbyists but aren't registered as lobbyists?
It's a technicality in both campaigns. If you register as a lobbyist, and there's about 30,000 registered lobbyists in Washington, D.C., that's a lobbyist in their mind. But there's probably 90,000 people in Washington, D.C. in the advocacy business, meaning people who build coalitions, who do grassroots lobbying, who market airplanes from Boeing to the Defense Department, who intervene in the regulatory process, who generally come as, quote, outside experts when called by committees on the Hill and members. You don't have to register if you do that. You collect all of those people in Washington. There's this advocacy business is huge, and there's a lot of those people in the both campaigns.
Are there any people at the top of Obama's campaign who have been lobbyists?
Tom Daschle, former senator, is the campaign chair. He is certainly in the advocacy business. He's not a registered lobbyist. To be a registered
lobbyist, he's a former Senate Majority Leader.
Former Senate Majority Leader. To be a registered lobbyist, you have to spend 25% of your time being paid for by a client and make at least two contacts each quarter on an issue for that client. Well, he spends 100% of his time advocating, but he doesn't need to register because there's huge loopholes in the law on that. He doesn't make direct contacts with members of the Senate unless he's asked. If he's asked to come up and talk to them or sees them socially, he doesn't need to register. Tom Daschle is not a farmer. He's not a real estate agent. He's an advocate in Washington and a very successful one. And he gives people advice about strategy. He opens doors. He brings together teams of people that lobby in coalitions, helps with grassroots and top-roots strategy. He definitely is in the advocacy business. So for that campaign to say that they have no lobbyists on the campaign and they will not talk to lobbyists after they get into office, again, is disingenuous, in my opinion.
Now, what about Joe Biden, the senator from Delaware, who is now Barack Obama's vice presidential nominee? Let's just take a quick look at him. Does he have connections to lobbyists?
All senators have connections to lobbyists. They have the right to come in and advocate, and they also try to take care of the companies in their own states, as he does in Delaware. He's very close to a very large credit card company. His son is a registered lobbyist. He tries to recuse himself from issues related to his son's lobbying, but it's very difficult because companies go to family members to advocate for them because they know they have close contacts with the father or the mother in the Senate or the House. Now, remember that Delaware is a place where there are a lot of corporate headquarters, and certainly Joe Biden is very close to most of those corporations, DuPont and a variety of others.
If there are fewer former lobbyists in the Obama campaign, what kind of people has he been going to for leadership within the campaign?
Obama set a high standard in terms of people being close to him that have had explicit positions paid for by outside clients. As a result of that,
his position is trying to avoid that, is what you're saying.
Obama's position is to avoid working with people who have been paid to advocate a particular position. He's moved to people who've been in government in the past in foreign and defense policy. He's moved to people in academia when it comes to economics, tax, and trade policy. He's moved to people that are on Wall Street, like Robert Rubin, who certainly has specific positions that he wants for the banking community, investment community, but he's moved to those people to get advice. So we get in immediately into a shade of gray of, well, is Rubin advocating what is in the public interest or is it in the private interest of the investment community that he represents in Wall Street? It is not clear sometimes when someone is advocating for a personal private interest and a public interest when talking to a candidate. But generally, I think Obama is talking to more people that are advocating for the public interest.
Obama has a lot of academics who have been advising him. Do you think that they're playing some of the role that former lobbyists play in some campaigns?
I think academics have their own values and they push those values, but they usually are not directly related to a very narrow private or specialized interest. They philosophically believe in a particular position when it comes to economics, and they're pushing that position because of the public interest. So they're really pushing what they think, and they may be mistaken sometimes, but what they think is the public interest rather than pushing an interest related to a client that has hired them to advocate for that position.
For a lot of people, just the word lobbying is a dirty word. Now, you've been studying lobbying and ethics and writing about it and teaching about it, advising people like Obama and McCain about it. Do you see lobbying as a dirty word? Do you think that, like, lobbying is just ethically wrong, period?
No, I think lobbying is part of the American democracy. We have First Amendment rights, which means that we can organize and petition government for grievances. We have freedom of speech. We have freedom of the press and freedom of religion. All of that grows groups in America, and we really have a form of pluralism or group politics that has a major impact. Now, most people in America think lobbyists are corrupt, but they don't think of lobbyists from the Catholic Church or the Boy Scouts or other organizations like that as corrupt. We have over 1 million groups, Terry, in America, probably 40,000 groups during a two-year cycle of Congress are involved one way or the other in advocating in Washington, D.C. That's just the way it works. And we've had some real outliers, scandals recently with Jack Abramoff, Representative Bob Ney, former Majority Leader Tom DeLay, Randy Duke Cunningham, William Jefferson, Democrat from Louisiana, that all led in the 2006 election to America saying, hey, the war is not the most important problem in the exit polls. That year, it was corruption. 74% of the people in the exit polls in the 2006 election felt that corruption and scandal related to lobbying was the most important issue. So people love to hate lobbyists, but they also want lobbyists when they've got a problem, and they want them to advocate for them.
Since your issue is ethics and lobbying, what are you keeping your eye on during the conventions?
Well, the conventions are places where lobbyists work through parties, social gatherings. I'm looking to see whether they're breaking the rules. The rules are very clear. You may not have a major party and spend money for a particular candidate in honor of that candidate. You can have a widely attended event where the candidate comes along with other people. You can help support through the political parties, the convention itself, and major corporations have done that. So I'm looking at new tools, actually, that they're using to try to influence members of Congress and other people from the states that are there. And one thing is to have a quote, educational event where you bring in a key member of Congress that's chair of a committee to talk about global warming, for example.
This gets around the rule that you're not allowed, a lobbyist isn't allowed to throw a party for one particular senator or congressman. So this gets around that rule?
Yes. There are various ways of getting around it, the rule for honoring a particular member, and one way is to have an educational event or a generally attended event on a general topic where you actually, in the end, honor that member, but it's not stated as an event honoring that member.
Is it frustrating for you? You advise senators and congressmen about how to create legislation that would make lobbying more transparent and curb some of the powers of lobbyists. Then they find ways to get around it.
Well, I think that the way Washington works is not so bad. The public has very bad attitudes about it, and that undermines the capacity to govern, undermines our democracy, so it's important. But the main thing I want is more transparency, make it easier for the public to know about campaign contributions, more about what lobbyists do and how much they pay. Why? Because I think it's important for the public to make a judgment between the public interest and very specific private interests. Frequently, private interests are behind the scenes. They're hidden. And I don't like that. I think it's better for the public to know about what lobbyists are doing, how much they're, what their targets are, and their expenditures. The lobbying reform went a long ways towards bringing more transparency and enforcement, but we have a long ways to go, in my opinion.
James Thurber, thank you so much for talking with us.
It's good to be here.
James Thurber is a distinguished professor of government and director of the Center for Congressional and Presidential Studies at American University. Don Cheadle first got the attention of critics and movie audiences with memorable supporting roles, like the country music-loving porn actor Buck in Boogie Nights and the unhinged criminal Mouse in Devil in a Blue Dress. But Cheadle gets lead roles nowadays. He played Washington, D.C. DJ Petey Green in Talk to Me and earned a Best Actor Oscar nomination for Hotel Rwanda. After shooting that film in Africa, Cheadle became an activist, calling attention to the genocide in Darfur, Sudan. Among Cheadle's other films are The Rat Pack, Crash, and Ocean's 11, 12, and 13. Cheadle stars in the new film, Traitor, a spy thriller that involves FBI agents trying to stop an Islamic fundamentalist group plotting terrorist attacks. Cheadle plays Samir Horn, a former American military intelligence operative who's become a devout Muslim whose loyalties are now in question. Cheadle spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies. Let's start with a scene from Traitor. Samir is in a Yemeni's prison where he'd gotten into a fight after sharing food with a defenseless inmate whom prison thugs had been bullying. Now he's playing chess with a member of a terrorist group discussing the loss of innocent life in a larger struggle.
I've been in a lot of battles. And it may have felt like a suicide mission at the time, but we always had a plan to come home.
You must be willing to sacrifice some of your pawns if you want to win the game.
I don't know.
I think you do. You risk your life to share your food with a stranger.
That's not the same thing. I was just doing my duty.
Well, Don Cheadle, welcome back to Fresh Air. I wanted to talk about the new film, Traitor. You know, the film begins with your character as a little kid in Sudan. Explain what happens there and how you think that shapes this character.
Well, we established the movie showing him in just a very typical setting with his father. They're playing chess. They're sharing tea. They're Muslim, so they go through their prayers. And then his father kisses him, and he leaves, and he gets in his car, and boom, the car goes up. And it sort of imprints him at a very young age as to what terrorism does, as to what this, especially this kind of methodology, how it rends. And it personally, he bears the brunt of that. And so that kind of sets him off on his path. So it makes sense, you know, as you go through the film to see where he comes down, on which side he comes down, on what he needs to do.
You know, this is a spy thriller, and it's an action film. I mean, there are explosions and gunplay and chases, but the ideas are serious and nuanced. And I know that you don't do the marketing for the films once your performance is done. But I'm wondering if there's a concern that, you know, there might be an audience for some of the ideas that are raised here that might not readily go to an action film if you market it that way, or is it an opportunity to get people who love action films to maybe think about some of these issues a little differently?
Well, I think you've leaned into hopefully what it will do, is that if people want to come and just kind of enjoy it on the thrill of the action, they can. But movies like this, I always want to smuggle in those ideas and have people, we don't have to lead with them, but I like it if people walk out of the movie with something to talk about. This film, we were really trying to, you know, this movie, it's really an opportunity to play in against a backdrop that does exist and have a character who's really at dealing with these questions in a personal way. To me, it was just interesting that we have a main character in this film who is a Muslim, who turns out to be the hero of the movie, and who is fighting with what it means to be a good Muslim and to be a good soldier and to be a good mate. And he's trying to figure out which, quote unquote, which God he's going to serve. So it's much more of a personal story than a story about than we're even educating people about, you know, the Islamic faith or radical Islam or Muslims or on the other side, you know, our government or what we're willing to do or our special operations or rogue, you know, elements inside of our government. It's really about this Samir Horn and the decisions that he's making moment to moment.
If you're just joining us, our guest is Don Cheadle. He's starring in the new film Traitor. You grew up in Kansas City, right?
Yep.
Is that right?
Dad was in Kansas City.
Dad was a child psychologist. Your mom was a teacher. And I read that you were in a fifth-grade production of Charlotte's Web and that you brought something really special to that performance. Is this Don Cheadle mythology, or is that where it all started?
Oh, I thought you were reading off of reviews. I'm sorry. I thought I have them in my wallet if you want me to. No. No, that was kind of the first, my first foray into it, into the theater, was playing Templeton the Rat in Charlotte's Web. And it was quite a stirring performance, if I do say so myself.
And you did stand up, right?
I did. I did it. I didn't formally do it. A friend of mine who I had gone to high school with, we're driving by, I think it's the Laugh Factory in Denver. I'm not sure what it's called. The Laugh Factory or Comedy Store, one of those. And they had an open mic night that night. And I said, do you think we could do that? And he's like, yeah, let's try. So we went back to my house, I remember, and kind of worked up some routine or whatever and came back and did the open mic night and crushed, you know, did great.
Huh.
And had a lot of fun, and the club owner was like, oh, that was pretty good. You guys, we're doing another one next week. You should try to come back and do it. So we did it the next week and came back and crushed again, you know, killed it. Great. It's beautiful. And the guy said, you know, we should actually think about maybe giving you guys a regular spot that people really seem to dig you. And we were kind of feeling ourselves a little bit. So we went back the next week, and I invited my parents to come see. And we didn't crush. We weren't that good. And that's the worst feeling in the world. I mean, dying on stage doing comedy is probably worse than being in a bad play, which is bad. But dying on stage in comedy, you know, you're just kind of laid bare. Nobody can rescue you. And you're looking at the clock like, we still have 4 more minutes we have to do.
So is that good training for a career in show business, to have your ego crushed and come back from it?
It's good training for a career in becoming an antidepressant addict, I think, is what it is a good training for.
Well, we should talk about the performance that got you an Oscar nomination in Hotel Rwanda. And I have to tell you, my son did a semester away in South Africa and saw this film in South Africa with a native South African who refused to believe that this Don Cheadle was really an American actor.
So
at least there you were entirely convincing. Tell us about how you got involved with this project.
Well, this was one of the couple of scripts that I had seen around the same time. The other one was Crashed. And I had just learned about what happened in Rwanda. I had known, like many people, knew nothing about it, and saw a Frontline documentary television show that was done about it, and was just, you know, devastated. And shortly thereafter, I saw the script. So I met with the writer-director, Terry George. And, you know, he kind of told me right up from the beginning, very straight up. He said, look, I've been trying to get this movie made for a couple of years, and I can't make it. I would love to make it with you. I think you'd be good in it. But if Will Smith steps up or Cuba Gooding Jr. steps up and the studio says they'll make it with them, I'm going to make it with them. And I said, I thank you for being honest. And, you know, I think you need to make the movie however you can make the movie, because it's really rare that you read a script like that where you just feel like it has to be made. However it has to be made, it has to be made. And I really was sincere when I said, look, I'll help you produce it. I'll try to help you raise money if you're trying to find money for it, whatever I can do to try and help this movie be made. And, you know, thankfully the role came my way and I was able to do it. But it was one of those things that felt at the time to me to be bigger than just some movie that was out there. It seemed to me to be a story that the world should kind of be made to notice.
And, you know, and I think it certainly is that. You play Paul Rusesa Bagina, who was a hotel manager of a 4-star hotel in Kigali, the capital of Uganda, when the genocidal attacks of the Tutsi erupted. And this hotel manager managed to save, I guess, about 1,000 people with his own kind of courage and guile. And I thought we should hear a clip from the film. This is at a moment in the film where the UN peacekeepers, who you and others had hoped would protect folks, the refugees in the hotel, from the attacks of the Hutu bands around them. The UN peacekeepers, in fact, left in buses with all of the Europeans, leaving you to fend for yourselves. And here you are breaking the news to your wife, played by Sophie Okonedo.
All the whites are leaving. They are being evacuated. But what about us? We have been abandoned.
But the soldiers will stop the killers.
Listen to me, Tassi, listen. I said all the whites are leaving, the French, the Italians, even the UN Belgian soldiers. All of them.
Who is left?
I don't know. Colonel Oliver said he has 300 UN peacekeepers for the whole country. The most he can spare for the hotel are 4 men. And they are not allowed to shoot. I am a fool.
No.
They told me I was one of them, and I... The wine, chocolates, cigar style, I swallowed it. I swallowed all of it.
And that's our guest Don Cheadle from the movie Hotel Rwanda. You know, I read that some refugees from the Rwanda genocide were part of the cast. Is that right?
Yes, not the cast, but the extras and a lot of the people that we had to sort of fill out the hotel. Yes, a lot of them were.
Yeah. What do you think that added to the film, to the performances?
Well, a lot of veracity. I mean, because people would come up to you and tell you the way you needed to be doing something or how something had gone down or the reality of it. And it always kept me in a frame of mind of what was really important and what we were doing it for and what it was about.
Can you recall a moment when someone came to you and said, gave you that kind of advice or an admonition?
Well, I remember one moment when we were shooting one of the hotel scenes, and I noticed that one of the extras was really, she was having a hard time. It was, I think it's the scene where the Interahamwe have come in the hotel and they're ushering people out into the carport and, by our understanding, are about to start killing them. And the woman was having a really hard time dealing with it. And I went to the woman that was consoling her and said, is she okay? Should she leave? Does she want to leave? And the woman, like, looked up at me and she said, no, I'm not leaving. And this is important, and we have to tell this story, and it has to be told right, and I'm participating in it, and I'm not leaving. You know, she was adamant about it. She just had to get through what she was dealing with emotionally. And later she came over to me and she lifted up her shirt and showed me her back, and she had these machete scars on her back and said, you know, this is not just a movie, you know, this is real to me. And it was like, wow. And that's when you feel a great responsibility, and you feel, you know, that you have to honor these people's lives who've, you know, given you their, you know, I felt like the spirits were there. I felt like ghosts were there saying, you know, get it right.
Now, I've read that your activism on the issue of Darfur grew out of your experience making this film. Is that right?
Yeah. We had a screening for this film at one of the MGM facilities in Los Angeles. And a congressman from Orange County, California, Ed Royce, approached me about coming along with he and several other congressmen and women on a congressional delegation to Sudan to see the camps, to talk to the NGOs there, and talk to the African Union peacekeepers there on the border between Chad and Sudan. And we were able to bring Nightline along, and Nightline documented it for us, and along with myself and John Prendergast and Paul Rusesabagina went as well. We were able to sort of bring this story back at a time when it was very underreported and very few people even knew where Darfur was or what it was or what was happening. And that sort of pushed me into a wave of activism and advocacy that was happening before I had gotten there. It just sort of made me a focal point of a lot of it, I think, is what happened.
Right. And you co-wrote Not on Our Watch, the book, and you were profiled in the film about called Darfur Now, right?
Yes. Yeah.
I wonder if the experience might have what you've learned about both the potential and the limits of celebrity activism. I mean, how it affects people's perceptions of you.
Well, I think at the beginning you get a lot of goodwill. I mean, at least you get attention. And there were those who would say to me, are you doing this just to get shine and you're just trying to have people look at you? I said, the only reason I'm trying to have people look at me is so that they look at them. You know, it's something that Brad Pitt had said, which is true. He's like, we can't get out of the light and they can't get in the light, you know. So you're trying to reflect and refract it so that it shines on the people that actually would do with having people follow them around and record what they're doing and becoming engaged in their lives so their stories can be out and people can find conduits to try and help them. So I know that there are limitations to it if your celebrity involvement starts to look like it's self-serving. But also, you can't play down to cynics. You know, I know what I'm doing. I know why I'm doing it. And I know what it means to me. So I just keep moving forward on the basis of that. And the people who it's helping, you know, and the people who are getting the attention, let me tell you what, they're very happy to have celebrities saying, look at us. They're very glad that people are pointing toward them and trying to drive attention in their direction.
You've done a lot of serious roles, but I thought we ought to hear from a kind of a fun character you did for the Ocean's 11 casino heist movie. This is Bashar Tar. He's the English explosives expert.
Wait, are you about to play a clip?
I was going to, yeah.
You're
going to
crush me.
I am.
Why? As long as I can't hear it in England, that's all right.
Did you take some grief for your accent on this one?
Did I? Do I? only every time I bump into anybody who's actually from there.
Well, I hate to inflict this on you, so cover your ears if you have to.
Do you hate to? Because it sounds like you're getting some delight in it.
Fun over-the-top performance. Here's Bashar Tar, and he's come to the crew that are getting ready to knock over this big casino, and there's some problem that he has discovered. Let's hear him.
That poxy demo crew haven't used the coaxial inch to back the main line, have they? They've only nosed up the mainframe couplet, nosed it right up.
Do you understand any of this?
I'll explain later.
Listen, they're so pony that they've gone and blown the backup grid one by one, like dominoes.
Bashar, what happened?
They did the same what I would have done, only they did it by accident. Problem is now they know their weakness and they're sorting it out. They're fixing it.
So?
So unless we intend to do this job in Reno, we're in Barney. Barney Rubble. Trouble!
And that's Don Cheadle from Ocean's 11. I don't know what's not to like about that. You know, your career has really developed gradually. You know, there was that really terrific performance in The Devil in the Blue Dress and, you know, going back to Boogie Nights. And you're now somebody who leads, who stars, who carries movies. Is fame a burden in any way to your personal life?
Do you know, it's really either I'm being surveilled at a distance and in a way that is actually pretty scary because they're not coming out with anything or I'm just so boring that nobody cares. And I think it's probably the latter. I don't have the weight on me that, you know, we see the people in the, you know, like Brad gets, like George gets, like Matt gets. You know, I got an email from Matt that he had his baby right before I got on the plane. And by the time I landed, my wife said, oh, Matt had his baby. I said, oh, do you know because he called you? She said, no, I'm reading it online. I'm like, oh, man, you know. So I'm not afraid with that kind of attention. And I really appreciate it because my kids don't like it. And I'm glad to be able to just run around with them kind of, you know, anonymously.
Well, I read that Brad Pitt once came over to your house and then you had to tell him, don't do that again because...
Yeah, he came and it was in People magazine the next day. I'm like, well, that's a wrap for you at my house, Brad, you know? So it's definitely, you know, you hear people complain about it and it's hard, you know, like, oh, poor celebrity. You know, he's got people following him and all these people just want to take pictures of him. No, it's not, oh, poor celebrity. But at the same time, it's like, would you want somebody... following you around in a car and chasing you down, you having to run in the house with your kids. It's not all it's cracked up to be.
Well, Don Cheadle, thanks so much for spending some time with us.
Thank you very much.
Don Cheadle stars in the new film Traitor. He spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies, a senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News. We want to set the record straight about something that was said on our show last week. On Friday, our critic-at-large John Powers did an appreciation of Manny Farber, a painter and film critic whose writing was very influential, although it didn't reach a mass audience. In John's piece, he said that politically, Farber was conservative. He twice voted for President Bush, but aesthetically, he was not. After the text appeared on our website, John received an email from Farber's widow, Patricia Patterson. She wrote, quote, "Manny was not a conservative, a libertarian, a Republican, and anything. He did not vote for Bush twice." Patterson went on to say, "Other than the political misinformation, I thought your piece was lovely and accurate." To read John's appreciation of Manny Farber and Patterson's full response, go to our website, freshair.npr.org, where you can also download podcasts of our show. We want to set the record straight about something that was said on our show last week. On Friday, our critic-at-large John Powers did an appreciation of Manny Farber, a painter and film critic whose writing was very influential, although it didn't reach a mass audience. In John's piece, he said that politically, Farber was conservative. He twice voted for President Bush, but aesthetically, he was not. After the text appeared on our website, John received an email from Farber's widow, Patricia Patterson. She wrote, quote, "Manny was not a conservative, a libertarian, a Republican, and anything. He did not vote for Bush twice." Patterson went on to say, "Other than the political misinformation, I thought your piece was lovely and accurate." To read John's appreciation of Manny Farber and Patterson's full response, go to our website, freshair.npr.org, where you can also download podcasts of our show.